To understand what goes on inside a motor, imagine a clock face with only a single long minute hand pointing straight up at 12 o'clock. That minute hand wants to stay still, but someone has pressed a small electromagnet into the face of the clock, smoothly recessed into the surface right where the 3 o'clock mark would be. When the electromagnet is switched on, the metal minute hand has no choice but to start turning clockwise, for it's pulled toward the beckoning magnet. If the magnet stayed on, the minute hand would stop at 3 o'clock, held quiveringly in position by the magnet's pull. Instead, imagine that just before the minute hand hits 3, some tormentor turns off the magnet and switches on a second electromagnet at the 9 o'clock position. The metal hand would whir past the 3 o'clock position by sheer momentum, but then, instead of slowing to a halt, would start to feel the pull from the magnet at the 9 o'clock position. If the trickery stopped there, the minute hand would reach 9 o'clock and finally come to rest. But no, imagine that just before it reaches that destination, the 9 o'clock magnet is switched off. The metal minute hand skims past it, the 3 o'clock magnet is quickly turned on, and the whole ridiculous spinning motion is repeated. The minute hand is like a greyhound racing after mock rabbits, perpetually kept out of reach. That's an electric motor. You can often hear this mechanism inside a running motor, for if there are two electromagnets, each whirring to a start and stop 110 times per second, there will be 220 separate whirs. That creates a hum not far from middle C. To get power from it, you just grab onto the part that's spinning round. Going back to our imagined example, if you hung a thread from the minute hand of this peculiar clock, the electromagnets luring the minute hand along in a circle would only be strong enough to tug along a doll-sized wicker basket hanging from the thread. Scale up the device, though, as Edison and others did, so that giant electromagnets are providing the power at the 3 o'clock and 9 o'clock positions in that motor, and the metal rod that's being tugged in a circle will be powerful enough to drag a ton or more of elevator straight up a shaft in a tall building. This was crucial for skyscrapers. Strong metal beams were necessary, too, but there would have been little enthusiasm for tall buildings if users had to climb up several dozen flights of stairs. With the electric elevator, no one had to. Land prices were high in central New York and Chicago, so it made sense to build vertically. Soon the skylines of those cities and others became spiked with these tall, electrically navigated buildings. Electric chargers that were billions of years old were now being manipulated to pull Victorian office workers up these narrow elevator shafts. If electric motors were a bit smaller, with a rotating metal rod just a foot or so in length, the spinning wheels of electric streetcars could be built. This produced a momentous change, for more and more people no longer had to live within walking distance of their factories or offices. A small number of wealthy individuals who could afford horses and carriages already were able to live like that, and steam-powered locomotives had made some mass commuting possible. Now, even more people could do it. Long-stretching suburbs burst into existence, growing along the new streetcar lines. Electric motors did more. Streetcar companies that had installed big power stations to pull their cars found that after 7 p.m., when workers were at home, there was little use for their product. What could they do with the spare capacity? One solution was the invention of the modern amusement park. Electrically operated roller coasters and brightly lit arcades appeared at the edges of cities throughout America and in parts of Western Europe. By 1901, most of the largest U.S. cities had such amusement parks, powered and owned by local electric streetcar companies. There was a lot of mingling in the amusement parks, and it was often of a sort that the older generation didn't want. Before inexpensive travel to such parks, poor and immigrant children usually socialized in the neighborhoods where they lived. It was easy for parents and neighbors to keep an eye on them. But when the kids could go to these new parks and meet almost anyone, that control broke down. Sometimes there was fighting and arguments as different groups collided. Often, though, there was courting and furtive kissing, and increasingly, marriages that cut across traditional boundaries. Industry changed, for the place where energy was made could be far from the place where it was used. The cable cars of San Francisco had been among the first mobile devices to rely on this principle, since lifting a heavy iron motor up and down San Francisco's hills was too hard even for steam engines. Factories that were run by electricity could now use the same techniques. Workers didn't have to huddle around tools that sat close beside a steam engine or were powered by a single long pulley belt. It wasn't even necessary to have a steam engine and its heavy coal supplies on the premises. Just as with the San Francisco cable cars, power could be produced dozens or hundreds of miles away and then fed in. Industrial cities expanded, even where there were no waterfalls or coal. Revolution was everywhere, even in the home. For the first time in history, glucose stored in human tissue was no longer the sole energy source available to power dreary domestic activities such as carrying, cleaning, and washing. Small electric motors took over many of those tasks. This shifted relations that had seemed locked in since time immemorial. When servants are on their knees banging sodden washing, or scrubbing out blackened fireplaces, or trudging up and down stairs with slopping buckets, they seem so different from someone with free time for conversation or reading that it's easy to imagine that the servant doesn't deserve to vote. In their exhaustion, servants can also feel that demanding the right to vote is too grand as well. This shifted relations that had seemed locked in since time immemorial. With electric pumps and motors to run washing machines, and later with electric refrigerators and sewing machines and more, there was less menial labor and, with that, less subservience. Votes for working-class men, and then the full heresy, votes for women, began to seem possible.